B-I-M-L-A, lazy. I just am. S I sitting back.
You're just sitting back and seeing what I'll do, right? You don't give me something to do, what'll I do? Well,
how did you M E E, how did you meet? F A T T, Father George. How did you meet Father George?
Okay. Boy, that's a story. The very early hippie thing was just happening. It was about 64, 65. I'm not too good on years. And I had moved into L.A. because I was sewing to support my, by now I have four children, three girls and my son. And I was selling stuff, so I moved into L.A. and opened a shop right when the whole thing starting to happen. People were, the first LSD was happening. People were buying trip clothes. Guys from groups were coming in. It was really an interesting time. And for New Year's Eve, I went to a KPFK New Year's Eve party with the boys in the band. And there was this man there that I kept watching. I was fascinated by him. And I did something that was very unusual for me. Before we left with the band, I wrote my name and phone number on a piece of paper. And I went up to this man.
That was not unusual.
Well, no, come on. No, I hadn't done that one. You know, I might have given him the eye or something. No, it wasn't that kind of thing. It was not that kind of a thing. I was just, I knew this person. It sounds silly to say it, of course, but I knew this person had some information for me that was important. It wasn't my usual jazz, right? You know, I gave it to him and I said, I feel like you have something for me and I would like to hear from you. And he phoned me, and that was Will, who was a filmmaker who was filming the very earliest commune in the L.A. area of Strawberry Fields. A guy named Gridley Wright had it out in the Malibu country, which, of course, burned down like most of the hippie things ended up happening.
M-T-R trying to get you get a C O O C O P a copy of
Will's
what?
Film.
Yes.
Well, I'll see what I can do about it, you know. I don't know where one is. It was called Infinity Equals One. And he has all this great footage of the really early thing that happened with this whole movement from the beginning. But anyway, he had gotten in touch with me. He called me. And I said, Gridley Wright's thing out there with this first commune, anybody could go out there, but the whole thing was you had to let it all hang out. You had to be open. And here I am with this clothing shop and says something looks like the devil on somebody. Do I say it looks like I'm the devil on them? No. That looks great, lady. And, oh, man, what a world if we could all just say it like we saw it. And I told Will, this man that I had given this paper to, I said, if I didn't have four kids, I would do that. And he said, because you have four kids, you should do that. And we got together, a commune started in L.A., and we called ourselves the House of the Seventh Angel, which is from Revelations, when the last angel blows its trumpet and says, the time is now. And, of course, we believe the time was now. It's always now. And then we moved up into Nevada City and spent time also here on the Haight. We had an apartment here on the Haight. I spent most of my time in Nevada City during this time. I loved the Yuba River and my kids and all that, but I was in and out of here then. What was the question?
How you met Father George.
Oh, okay. Well, when I first threw this, when I first came up, George had one of the early communes was up in the Santa Cruz Mountains, up at Boulder Creek, called Holiday. And I go there with my friend Elizabeth, who you know, Elizabeth Gipps from Santa Cruz. And as we walk down, the group, there's, I don't know who all the Grateful Dead, I mean, all these guys. I mean, I don't know who was who, you know, all these great musicians are playing. And I see this wild man out there with his bushy hair like people had then, dancing. And I just jumped in and started dancing with him, you know, It was great. That's how I first met him. And then I became friends with him later. You know, that was just kind of how I met him. And then later on through this whole communal thing that was happening mainly around San Francisco, Berkeley, up in this area. When I took my kids and moved back to this place I had in San Bernardino, some of the people from this communal thing came there, and we lived extended family, and that was when I first became really involved with Frank.
What is that?
What is what?
What is an extended family?
Well, I was there with four children. George lived there. There were three or four other people. The house had all these kind of separate buildings around it that we had fixed up with stained glass and all this stuff. And instead of just living there myself with my children or a marriage, it was everybody was living there. And we went through all sorts of stuff. I mean, we went through confrontation like you wouldn't believe it. And we all had so much buried anger. Sometimes I thought we were going to tear each other to pieces, you know, with when there would be conflict between two people in the house. We'd all get around the table and get it out, you know, and work it out. We all had our exit lines. That was one of the rules. You could leave. And mine was, I don't see why we can't all get along. Everybody, you know, had their little line they would say when the pressure got on them too much. It was really worthwhile. It was really worthwhile. It was very painful to go through because we weren't used to that, you know, really getting it out and saying it. People don't do that much.
I do.
You do. I know you do. Mm. Everybody tells you to shut up.
But, no. All my life.
They've been telling you to shut up, are you?
Yes.
Yeah, of course. Of course. You can say more with an E, Frank, than most people can with, you know, 100 pages. Yeah.
They should say K-E, keep talking. You think that might shut you up if they told you to keep talking?
That would shut me up?
No, that might shut him up.
No. Well, I find now, really, I don't feel that everybody has to understand me or I have to understand everybody. I think now you say your piece and then let everybody kind of think whatever they want to think is kind of how I relate. But I don't spend much time with people like that, you know. Now, there's plenty of people you can be open with and you can say it like you feel it. But there sure wasn't when I was growing up. I mean, everything was artificial.
What changed? What changed that?
I really think the hippie thing changed that. You know, the beatnik thing was a thing of nihilism, iconoclasm. Mm-hmm. We're breaking the old images. And I think that had to happen before there could be this surge of hope that the early hippie thing was. It was I am you and you are we and we are all together, you know, and this whole vibration hit the planet at that time. LSD, the Beatles, for sure. And now it sells toothpaste. You know, we need something new. I wish something new would come up. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'm concerned. I mean, I know some of the, it has to be the youth. It's always the youth, you know, that do it. And I don't know.
W, the We Fest, people like the people that put on that festival in North Carolina.
Yeah,
that we
but I don't see that much of that. I see everybody trying to get a good job, to get a good, your education is not for education, it's to get a job. Mm-hmm. You know, I see the vast majority of the kids are not rebelling.
F.A. Fake Radio has a C H A N chance to be that M O T I V A
motivation. Well, see, you guys, I mean, I don't know about this. You know, I can't make any comment on this because I'm up in the mountains of Mexico now. You know, all this internet and all this is I'm a virgin on it. I don't understand it. I hope there's hope for the world in all this, but it's not part of my reality. I mean, it is right now. All this equipment, lights blinking. But I hope so, Frank, because I don't know what there's any hope if it isn't this. You know? You know, because you certainly on commercial radio or commercial TV or film or in the new, oh my God, you know? You don't hear any kind of real truth. It's all the commercial corporate slant, you know. But I guess with internet, people all over the world are saying what they see. For a long time when I was traveling, you know, around the world, I could see this network going on between people on the traveling on the cheap, mainly students and people on sabbaticals, teachers and whatnot, and great communication that way. And it still happens on the beaches in Mexico. You know, there are people down from our country, of course, but a lot of people like from Scandinavia or France or Germany or whatnot. And they're all, that's a very free thing. Kind of like the street people thing was, where people, you know, they get together and play music and are pretty open and pretty free and very political as far as what they say. There's tremendous agreement, you know, with people all over the world, but it doesn't get out to the voting majority who are worried about our president's sexual perversions or whatever they want to call it, you know. I mean, good God.
A, B, O, A, T, a boat, S, A, N, sank, U, N, under, U, a boat. Oh, when you.
Oh,
traveling.
When I was in Sumatra. Mm-hmm. You want me to tell a boat story?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I was telling.
You
this.
Are the I N T E R International B A
Bag lady. International bag lady. Yeah, after my kids were raised, I took off to go see the world. And I was telling this story to someone. She said, gee, that was a perfect trip. She had dengue fever and the boat sank on her. But, you know, I thought I had Indonesian well enough to get off the tourist path. And I didn't know Api means fire. I'm in this little boat going down the Siak River. It's in the morning, and I'm in the front of the boat all night. I had first class, which meant you had about this much on a board, and it was right behind where the engine. It was so hot. Yeah, and it was so hot down there. I was terrified of being in that room with all these people. The Indonesian people stayed there because they had their things. I thought, if they rip me off, let them take it. Mm-hmm. And so I slept above deck on the. They had all these onions. I slept upstairs with all the onions, which was really just fine. And in the morning, I'm in the front of the boat. I'm wondering if there might be alligators around, or we're going through all these mangrove. We're getting close to the mouth of the sea, where the sea is. Everybody's going crazy. People are jumping overboard. People are screaming. They're grabbing their children. They're all rushing to the front of the boat. There were some Indonesian soldiers on board. They're shooting their guns up in the air. Oppie. A man I had met in Pekanbaru, an Indonesian man, spoke very limited English, but he spoke some English. And he had told me he would watch out for me because there really are pirates in that area. It really wasn't a safe trip. And he said, fire, can you swim? And I turned my head, man, and that flame, shoop, up it was going. And I didn't think about anybody or anything. I just dove overboard and swam rapidly away from the boat. Eventually, because the soldiers had been shooting their guns up in the air because there were little tiny fishing villages along. So people came in their fishing boats. And here I am in the water. I mean, I'm thinking, what am I doing here? You know, I could still see the cumulus clouds in the water. It was fine, really, you know. And I could see the boat burning. And the few people, Indonesian people don't swim. They use the water as their sanitation. They shit in the water. And in the ocean, there are sea snakes and things like that. So they're not swimmers. The few Indonesian people who could swim were getting people and getting them over to the mangrove trees where they could hold on. Well, anyway, so I'm out there treading water. And this boat comes, and this little tiny Indonesian man is trying to pull me up out of the water. Finally succeeded. I stepped over a dead woman, and somebody was holding a little girl about 3 years old upside down. And I took the child without any thought, and I did artificial, you know. And on about the third time, I blew in her mouth. She went, and so then I just sat with her upside down, and eventually we were all taken to this village. And there were dead bodies. There were 169 people dead, drowned, out of what I would assume were maybe 225 or 250 people. And the Indonesians feel so totally different about death. I mean, I'm pretty good in any kind of an emergency. But after we're in this village, the tears just kept coming. And the Indonesian people are making little fires and they're drying their things out. And they were so concerned, like, was I hurt? Because their idea of death, it's really a whole different ball game over there. And then days later, the only other non-Indonesian on the boat was a black boy from Ghana who had been in a missionary school and had left with his Bible to teach the ways of the Lord. And he goes to Indonesia, man, everybody's starving. The Indonesian people took him in and shared their rice. He didn't even know he was off a tourist path. You know, all the Lonely Planet books and whatnot that help you get around the world. He didn't even know about those. And everybody else, and when the Indonesian people, after this happened, people would see me. You know, they give me what they call a bagusan, you know, the thumbs up sign, you know, and they, all the sharing with some of those people, of the survivors. And it was days later, finally, Robert and I eventually make it into Singapore. Now, it's a whole different trip there than Indonesia. Singapore is must be the loveliest city in the world. We get off this boat, and I've still got pants on that I've been in the river with, right? And, God, there's street lights and sidewalks, and it's neat and tidy. And we have no money, but I did have my money in traveler's checks and a belt. So the first thing is to change it. Robert and I are walking down the street one way. Coming toward us was a very small Indonesian-looking man and a black man. And as they came toward us, I said, "Excuse me, do you speak English?" They said, "Of course. You know, I mean, it's bilingual. Yeah, and, you know, everybody else speak English. What's your problem?" It turned out Robert and the black guy were from the same tribe in Ghana. And these guys took us to a restaurant and fed us and got us a room. And, of course, I'd lost my address book. All my stuff had sunk with the boat. But I had a friend who had invited me to stay with her in Singapore, but I didn't have her address. But I called my kids, and I had told them the address. And the next day, this guy from Ghana was there, and he said, "I'm at your disposal, however I can help you." So I ended up in Singapore happily with a guest room with my own bath. Good Lord, what a trip. But as they say, it was successful. Dengue fever and a boat sinking was a good trip. And it was. You know, you don't want these things to happen, and I'm really cowardly. I mean, I would never jump out of an airplane, or I think people are crazy to hang glide, or... But life does put you into these situations.
J-U-S, just A-C-H-A, just a chapter in your life.
Yeah. I must say, life is interesting. Yeah, I get shy about talking about my life, you know, Frank. This is a little difficult for me. I have this happen sometimes. I go see friends who know a lot about me, and they've talked to me about me, to friends of theirs. I can't say a word. I get real shy. So you talk.
He, you, you, C, A, came to N, E, to New York City, to...
All right. To deliver Kaylin and Koala. Yeah, I got all involved in the really early birth movement, home birth movement.
B, E, because the H, O, the hospital would not L, E, let me, O, be there for the even on the floor where the birth was going to take place, because I was a Crip, and I Will, I would, F, R,
freak them out.
Freak them out. The, O, the other, mothers, out.
Well, the other mothers were freaked out even before they'd even see you, Frank. They had those women, they wouldn't allow them out of caged beds, you know. I mean, it was just horrible what was happening with birth. So when the home birth movement got started, I couldn't not deliver babies. I would try to talk people out of it. I didn't really, after I had delivered two babies before I had really any medical training, just because it was happening and I was a little bit older. My children were all born in the hospital and it was horrible. And so finally, after two births, a doctor friend said, look, I better... It was a woman who was at Santa Barbara when they were doing pepper gas on the students in those days. I forget what years those were. And I got training and I still didn't think I would be myself as a midwife. But people were having children at home and would I come? And I wasn't going to pull on a breech, right? That's what's Frank's story. I don't know how many people know that that's the story with Frank. He was a breech baby and the doctor pulled. And therefore, you know, all this damage happened. And I had delivered 29 babies saying, where's the doctor? When finally Dick Moskowitz, you know, and the people started showing up who were into the home birth movement. And now there's loads of midwives. When I went back and delivered those babies in New York, Frank, I talked to the legal nurse midwives in New York. And they were saying, oh, I wish I could do births like that. Well, you could, except you could also, you also had your neck out to be prosecuted for practicing medicine without a license, or in the case of a stillbirth, for murder. That's how it was, and it's not that way anymore. There's loads of good midwives and home birth.
So it wasn't legal at that point?
Oh, no. And the doctors didn't want to touch it because of insurance, and not because, I mean, it's safer. You're in your own bacterial field, and I mean, it's just better all the way around. But, so people were just having babies at home with nobody. You know, that's how I really got into it. And after the first two births, I mean, it was lovely. They were lovely. I mean, I didn't know what's going on. I just, it looked all right to me, you know, so I was, well, I mean, really, I didn't really know. You know, it was happening, the baby was coming, and nobody needs to do anything, although birth can become a medical problem. It's more apt to be a medical problem if they're in the hospital, that's for sure. Then the third, after I'd gotten this, I stayed with this doctor for a week in Santa Barbara. And she taught me to suture on a pork roast, so that I really only had one episiotomy to do that was ever necessary. But I got back to Santa Fe, and a friend of mine said, please, my sister's going to have her second child at home. She hasn't seen a doctor, refuses to. Would you come to the birth? So I met her, and I said, yeah, but I did find one doctor who wouldn't do home birth, but he said he would examine her. So I made this appointment for her on Monday. Sunday night she has a baby. But then my friend Kathy, her younger sister, had been at the birth. And then Kathy tells me that she is pregnant and would I deliver her baby. And that was the first one I didn't try to really talk out of it. Because now, you know, I'm getting a feeling for what's the norm. I've had this training. I'm reading Williams Obstetrics. Scare anybody to death reading that, you know. But so I'm real pleased, and it was a real blessing to be with those births and those babies.
But it was illegal.
Oh, yeah, it was illegal. You better believe it was illegal. Yeah. But, you know, there were cases where there was no one with any knowledge there at all. Like people will say, you know, I wanted to have a home birth, but it's a good thing I didn't because the cord was around the baby's neck. Hey, bullshit. All you do is cut it. It's better to not cut it because the baby gets the extra blood. It's no big thing. You know, but there were cases where the in one case the father freaked out, started pulling. People would freak out. The mother's uterus was inverted. She was dead on arrival. So how was I not gonna go? You know, I mean, you have to do the best you can.
Yes.
You know. And I was at the first nurse midwife meeting in El Paso. The midwife down there, boy, she was really something. People would come across the border from Mexico wanting their child to be born in this country.
Yeah.
They'd come across when they were in labor and knock on her door.
Wow.
And she was delivering those babies.
Wow.
You know. You know, most of my women, you know, I got them real early and real early in their pregnancy. And I had the lab work done, you know, the blood pressure and the urine, you know, and I worked with doctors for backup always. Or as soon as I found one or knew what to have them do. But,
D-O, doctors who were willing to our risk.
Well, no. Early on, there wasn't any doctor who was willing to risk. There was a Seventh-day Adventist doctor in Santa Fe who, you know, I tried him. And I said, you know, what was happening, like when I say that I made an appointment for on Monday, he agreed that he would check her out, but he wasn't going to have anything to do with the birth. I delivered 29 babies before any of these doctors, these young, beautiful doctors showed up who were into the home birth movement. And it was really nice working with them, you know, like many times... I would take a doctor's birth, or they would take mine, or we would go together, and I, you know. So then it wasn't any problem. But early on, I got this, God bless this doctor, who would get lab work done and do what he could, but he would not, you know, he wouldn't do home birth, you know. And then then I was delivering babies in Santa Barbara, and there was a doctor I got to do the lab work there who really wanted to do home birth, but he wanted to take the hospital to the home.
Mm-hmm.
And that isn't what you want.
Right.
If you've got a problem, you want to get to the hospital. You know, and God bless those doctors. They're good in an emergency. You know, I've watched them hold the baby's head just perfect on the monitor while they sat up and did a cesarean. The thing about birth, people think, oh, the birth is a big thing. No, it's the labor. If it all goes well, when the labor doesn't go well, you go where they do emergency work, and they're good at it.
That is what happened with Joe.
Yeah, with Joe. She was slow labor, which is not really any problem, but all of a sudden her labor came on real fast. And when that happens, you have to have a placenta that's separating, and you want to go to the hospital, which we did. And I think almost all the babies that were born in a hospital, because it could have been a medical situation, probably would have been okay at home.
Yeah.
But, you know, why... You know, we're not playing games here.
Yeah.
We've got a life here, and if it becomes medical, you go to the hospital.
Yeah.
And so I felt that As long as there's a normal thing of birth, a woman doesn't need anybody around. She's going to have that baby just dandy. So that was mainly what I felt my role as a midwife was, is if this is going to become a medical problem, if it goes away from the norm, they're good when it gets to that point.
Yes.
But they're not very good about keeping it away from that point, or they weren't. I mean, I know it's all changed now, too. Hospitals have birthing rooms today. It's a totally different situation today. And today, any woman who really wants a home birth can have it, you know. And they don't keep them in caged things, having the, you know, it's just much more enlightened.
F. You. Funny. I. V. I. Videoed. A. Birth. Oh, in a hospital? Right. This would have been like in the late 70s. Somebody who was having a natural birth.
Oh, natural birth, but in the hospital.
So we were there with our video camera videotaping the whole thing. So that's how far it came from.
Yeah.
And the F. A. Father. Oh, was a guy in a wheelchair.
Uh-huh.
And there was no problem with him being in the room.
Yeah.
Having the
baby. You know, there are areas in the world that are getting much better.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I understand. I mean, I don't keep up with this now. I'm not delivering babies now. I was asked to deliver a baby in Mexico from some friends of mine. And I didn't feel I should. I don't know that normal sound of the heartbeat now or things like, I miss the births. But, I'm not doing it now, so. That was then. And after working with birth, I had the blessing of working with hospice, working on the other end when people are leaving at home.
What?
Death.
Is that?
Well, that was where people are terminally ill and who don't want to go to the hospital. They don't want to be on tubes. They want to just go in their bed peacefully, thank you. And that's really the way to go. You know, I'm not afraid of dying as a result of what the people taught me. It's just like it was the women who taught me about birth, not the doctors, not William's obstetric. It was the women. And the same thing with death. People say, well, they were in such pain. Well, they were in pain in the hospital. And I'm not, I can't speak for all of it because I don't know. Maybe some of them are better off in the hospital. I don't know. But I know, you extend life past what the person would do by keeping them alive longer, and it's just all these people suffering in hospitals long periods of time because they're so afraid to die, you know? And I have seen the experiences I've had with death as it doesn't hurt, you know? I remember one woman, I'm rubbing her back, and I realize she's not breathing anymore. Marjorie? Where are you, Marjorie? Nobody home anymore. You know, they're gone. And the body looks just fine. But see, this is something else that we've lost our touch with birth, and we've lost our touch with death. You know, we go to funerals, and people die in the hospital. It's a way. You know, we're going for immortality in the body today, which scares the bejesus out of me what they're doing with biogenetics. And now they've got the cell stems where they can create any organ. So we're going to quit having babies so everybody can just take up the space on Earth, the old people. I mean, it's really crazy. Don't believe that there aren't people being cloned today, man. If they can clone the sheep, don't you know somebody's being cloned? And all these transplants, and we're supposed to be good people and donate our organs so somebody can live a few more years. I don't know. It's a wrong, we're going down the wrong track on all that. If they can do it, they will do it. They can do it, they are doing it. DNA characteristic traits. Who wants an aggressive child? Nobody.
Who wants me?
I want you, Frank. I want you. They wouldn't have caught you. Your birth defect. Your genes are probably just dandy. You know, probably the best genes going. You know, but that's the truth. You know, and they. And who wants girls as opposed to boys? Everybody wants the son, right? I mean,
they don't R-E-A really realize that is what M-A makes. EV evolution happen.
Right. We don't know what's connected to what. We have no idea what's connected to what. And there's this bank of things. It's taken us billions of years to evolve to where we are, and already the sperm pool is wrecked. Mm-hmm. They keep people alive that shouldn't, you know, immediately we do surgery. Well, that's on the genetics on a lot of this stuff. Well, somebody's got something to say about it.
What? Heidi does volunteer massage for hospice.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So she knows what... how it is. And people work things out. A lot of working with hospice where I felt I helped the most was the families. Because they would try to act like everything's going to be hunky-dory because of their fears of death, their denial. And that usually the people who were hospice patients accepted it. Or they'd be in the hospital going through the numbers. One woman, I called her because it looked like her mother was going to go. I thought she might want to come. She came and she went in the bedroom and I left to leave them time alone. She came out and she burst into tears in my arms. She said, oh, I was so afraid I'd break down in there. I said, honey, you go in there and cry with your mama. You know, I mean, let's get real here, you know. And or one woman, Helen, had a couple of days left to live. And her husband's trying to have her take one more bite of Jell-O, bless his heart. And she says to him, she says, don't bully me anymore. You know, I mean, you see...
Death is a P, a part of life.
Yeah. Yeah, it is, and we're all going to make that big trip. We're all going to make that big trip. And nobody knows. Nobody knows what's on the other side.
It is H E A. Healthy to die.
Yes, of course. of course. I mean, that's the play. You know, we don't really know why we're here or where we're going or how we got here.
But it is. Not healthy. It is not healthy. No, it is not of C. Oh, course in the for the medical world that you say, of course, it's healthy to die. That's what you said, of course, and Frank said it's not of course for the medical world.
Oh, no, it's and I understand that. I mean, when life is in your hands, you want to do all you can to preserve it. You know, I mean, I don't think we can blame the doctors on this. We can blame the pharmaceutical companies that pay to support the medical schools that train the doctors, you know. But it's more on a spiritual level for each person, I think. I think unless you accept death, I don't know. I mean, yeah, I must say it gives me a few shivers, you know. What's it like when we're not here, you know? But the process of dying, and I trust this is life is dandy. Whatever, you know, it is, and even if it's nothing, it's dandy.
I have always been you curious
about what it's going to be
after death.
I think we're all, yeah, I think so, curious. You know. Well, I mean, you know, it's a matter of faith, but, you know, I really believe that we're not even here. I really got heavy in the Course of Miracles, right? This is all illusion, gang. You know, we think we are here in this ego. And that this is all there is to it, and I know that's not true. My personal feeling is probably after we die, it's not much different. You know what I mean? Yeah. I mean, they, you know, wherever we are. It's in our heads where we are.
What? Let's see. Is there one that you want me to see what is going on here? The only unhealthy is fighting it.
Right.
The soul fragment we're given can't deal with death at first shock. It does not understand it, just like when you're born, existence is a shock. It was just a part of perfection a split second ago. Love can be a shock to it, too, but you're drawn to love, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be a need. This is all Cyberpup talking in the chat room. Shock is the CHALL challenge.
Well, you know, with birth, you know, I've had babies come out. Of course, they come out nose down and then they kind of turn for their shoulders. And I've had babies before they were out even. Their shoulders went out, their heads turned, and I swear, focus right in the eyeball. You know, this is a fallacy that babies don't see at birth. That's because they put the nitrates in their eyes and the bright lights and all of that. But how do they know to look you right in the eye and focus? And then I think of other things like children love to be thrown in the air. Most children believe they can fly. You know, we have these angels that fly. I mean, there's a lot of stuff. And, you know, I've wondered with death if somebody's on the other end. Saying, well, here she comes, you know.
Just like in birth.
You know, somebody's commenting on that, too.
It seems to be a need. A part of what's missing... so he didn't realize we were reading everything he's saying out.
He said what?
He said, oh, I didn't know that this was live, that we were going to be reading. He didn't know we were going to be reading what he was typing. Right. Okay. What we know as our lives seems to be how we deal with it, the point in the middle.
Uh-huh. That's all we can deal with.
The N-O. The now.
The rest is all a dream. If the past exists, where is it? You know, where is it? Well, let's get that.
If you take one part of perfection away, all of a sudden it needs. Now you have action. It's not whole.
Mm.
We are getting deep.
Yeah, well, you know, we can go off in the cloud zone, you know. It's, you know, actually, you guys, I'm falling asleep on you.
Yeah.
You know.
It's almost 12 o'clock. We kept you almost 2 hours.
Yeah, I mean, really, it's been a long day.
Yeah.
And, so, May I leave, Frank?
Yes. And I will piss. No, is that it? No, I will P-I-P-U put a T-A, tape on, you mean put a tape on now? Yeah. And pee and piss and D-R and have a drink. Then S-I and then sing. You and until Cyberpup takes over at 1. Okay, so let's see. Cyberpup says it's a terrific show, guys. And Corey, Heidi, Alexi said this is incredible. I love it. Cyberpup says a people's history. We love it too.
Mm-hmm. Well, good.
You go, bud.
Good night. Time to bed. Good night, Mikey. Mm. That was so interesting, you guys. I can't even believe the high-tech world.